Mary, it's a really, really wonderful talk, and I really, really loved how you went between the notion of homing devices on the one hand as a way of speaking about net culture, internet, and queer subjectivity, between homing devices and the notion of unbelongingness on the other. And I wonder if you could talk about sort of two things. Is queer research a way of talking, leading the way really, in talking of how you can rematerialize the body of desire in the language of virtuality on the one hand? And on the other hand, is there a more lurking importance of queer research itself, that it's sort of like an echoed research coming right back in the body? It's another way of thinking, in fact, of our own bodies of desire as always continuously being set in this recognition between unbelongingness and the lost homing devices of the body.
Yes. Let me just parse that into a few different bits. One way to get into this is what I think of as the two whatevers, and of course there's lots of whatevers, but we'll imagine a line, and on this line, in one location, we have somebody like Giorgio Agamben. Agamben, if you haven't read The Coming Community, it's an incredibly eloquent philosophical text. And Agamben talks about whatever. And his notion of whatever is a way philosophically, and I'm not a philosopher, so if you're a philosopher, please cover your ears, because I'm sure that my rendition will be very different from yours. Agamben talks about whatever form life takes, which is his way of talking about singularity. And the importance of singularity, philosophically, of course, is a way for us to think about coming together without emphasizing any kind of categorical notions of the same. And so we're all singular, we're all unique. And that philosophically, this is a very significant way to think about pluralism and some notion of a democratic society. And then there's another whatever. And this is one of these arguments that I set up for myself as a way of thinking about this. So the other whatever on this line is way over here somewhere. And this is the whatever of Second Life. And I don't know how many of you have been to Second Life. It's an online. You're much too studious to go to Second Life. Anyway, if you're interested in media, you really have to go to Second Life. It's one of the fastest growing multiplayer online communities. Just one of the bizarre things about Second Life is that you have to pay to play, but you're not paying to play because there's no game per se. The only game is to build things and buy things. And I think that the last I checked, there were well over a million people on Second Life. And UBC, amongst other, lots of universities have purchased real estate in Second Life. So you purchase real estate in Second Life. I won't go into the details. Except that you have to use real money to purchase this real estate. American Apparel has a company in Second Life. And Second Life, in some ways, is the instantiation of any kind of idealized notion of cyberspace. That whatever you want to be, whatever you want to build, that's how the makers of cyberspace foreground, that's how the makers of Second Life foreground what's interesting about Second Life. So if you have any kind of interest in theoretical notions of cyberspace, here's an interesting place to go and see, okay, well, what do people do? Here we have a perfect environment for whatever, except that it's cultural capital, as Bourdieu helps us to understand, only goes in one direction, and that's up. And so, for example, there are really only two genders, as far as I'm concerned, in Second Life. There's Barbie and Ken. Nobody's old. Nobody has a cane. Nobody's in a wheelchair. It's an extraordinarily narrow representation of what it is to be human. And so there's a way in which I think one of the strategies of queer research Foucault and so on and so forth, has been to try to grapple with the problematization of the incredibly interesting practices that are involved in creating a life, any life, and to be able to take into account both philosophical notions, say, of particularity that are incredibly important, and at the same time to recognize, as Foucault pointed out many times, it's not enough to be gay. We also have to create a gay life, and a gay life is about becoming. And so there are these very complicated notions, both of paying attention to keeping open these spaces of belonging, these spaces of belonging as mobility, not belonging as in the comfy wumpy, and singularity. And at the same time, and this is what is interesting to me about cultural studies and why I find it so useful, is that it's also about looking at what is it that people make. Give people an open space and see what they do. And then how can we navigate a space that theoretically is space for thinking about keeping the philosophical projects going as we think about how to theorize practice. It's an answer to one of the questions anyway.
Other questions?
Yes.
Well, I just wanted to say thanks, because you totally changed how I think about the internet, and it's becoming way more important, obviously, and it's going to have a huge impact on the rest of my life. So, yeah, that's, like, kind of scary to see how class and other development ideas can be reinscribed so easily through the internet, and even, like, more intensely than they are in, you know, the so-called real world, because you have an opportunity to, like, completely reify abstract notions that, you know, don't necessarily even need any concrete reality. Mm-hmm. So, wow. So resistance. How do we like? Have you thought about that? Like, how? Do we,
I'm particularly fond of Warner's notion of counterpublics. It's a way of thinking about social space that isn't the kind of Habermasian liberal notion of public space as this place where we can all come together and speak to each other and be all right. Like, whoever got to do that.
Yeah.
And Warner's idea of counterpublics, some of the key facets involve a relation of subordination to a dominant culture, a stranger sociability, and his book on counterpublics, I'm sure you would find very interesting. Practices of counterpublics are one way of thinking about what it is that people do in spaces of sociality where there is a dominant culture, and it's a way of looking at practices without so much, I mean, theorizing something like resistance as if, you know, I can just fight back against. We have to think about ideology in a way that isn't quite so monolithic, and I think counterpublics is a useful way to do that. One of Judith Butler's essays that I find people rarely quote, but it's quite wonderful, it's in a collection of essays in honor of Stuart Hall from the Birmingham School of Cultural Studies, very important figure. And it's called Agencies of Style for a Liminal Subject. There aren't a lot of places where Butler goes into what we might think of as the space of talking about agency, which could be interpreted as a prescriptive kind of rhetorical move. But she does in some detail in this essay, and so it's useful because her notion of how it is that we occupy spaces where ideology is inscribed in the process of subjection is through resignification. A little bit abstract, what's resignification? Well, she dedicates this essay on agencies of style for a liminal subject to talking about that resignification. And she focuses in particular on Foucault and his work pertaining to forms of life particularly participation in the gay men's SM community. And so she talks about the practices and participating in SM as an agency of style, going with this notion of style, of course, that the Birmingham School was famous for. So those are two places that I think are interesting.
Can I interject with another question?
Wait, let's see if somebody else has a question.
Okay.
Unless you're like all in the class and you wouldn't interrupt.
Even if they were in the classroom.
Okay.
Thank you very much. The agencies of style.
Yes.
I know that Zizek just visited UBC last week, so I was wondering how the agencies of style correspond with and against Zizek's notion of ideology, but also as a sort of recuperation of the real. It's a naughty question.
Well, Zizek. Here's what I think is interesting about Zizek. Zizek talks about the post-ideological subject. So this is the subject of hypercapitalism, where you know that you shouldn't go to Starbucks. But you go to Starbucks anyway, and you know that other coffee places are going to shut down. You know that they don't care about canopy coffee growing or anything else. But whatever. That's his post-ideological subject. The subject who is very much aware of the forces of ideology as opposed to being acted upon by those forces. So Zizek is giving this talk at UBC last week, and he's talking about the discourse of terror, which is timely, and he's talking about the construct of the neighbor. So you think that your neighbor is some kind of monster, and it's a way of thinking about of our projective abjecting of the other. So that's very nice, very elegant. Then he starts to talk about Wendy Brown's work. Wendy Brown, Judith Butler's partner, and he starts to enumerate all the things that are wrong with Wendy's current work. And I'm thinking, well, this is very odd. Perhaps it's a little much to go after Butler directly. And then he ends by literally putting her back in the closet, saying that she's a closet liberal, which is a very strange kind of discursive move. And then he goes on to relay a conversation that he apparently had with Butler, where he is, and this is all in the talk, there's 450 people in this packed auditorium, and people are loving it, they're practically cheering. So, then he goes on to talk about his conversation at the cocktail party. So he's talking to Judith, he refers to her as. And he's asking Judith whether this woman theorist, and I'm thinking, gosh, it's a while since I've heard that. That's like woman doctor. This woman theorist is a degenerate freak like you. Okay. So the talk carries on, and there's some jokes, of course, there's always jokes. Jokes about Marx, Lenin, and Stalin, and whether they would prefer a wife or a mistress. And then we get to the question period, and nobody asks anything, really, except about his last comment in the talk, which was that we should learn, and not take action. And so there we are. We should learn, and not take action, like not actually stand up and say anything about what we've just heard. And so my my experience of that was an experience of the limits of resignification, the limits of the agencies of style for a liminal subject, in the sense that we're often in a scenario where, and I think this is why Butler, in The Psychic Life of Power is an incredible book, particularly the section on Freud and Foucault. Why is it that we have to bring Freud and Foucault together? What is it about this experience of the internalization of repudiation, of subjection? What is it that is so absolutely horrifying to conceive of as a space of anything except the space of identification in the everyday that both makes it possible for us to exist and to interact, and yet in many cases is absolutely not a space from which it's possible to resist or to even resignify in any kind of concrete way? And so I think that there are very interesting things about Zizek's notion of the post-ideological that are extremely significant in terms of thinking about how it is that cynicism produces a vexed relation to subjectivity. And it gave me a chance to talk about my Zizek experience.
Other questions?
I just would like a point of clarification. You're talking about how performances and online communities are often homogeneous, and that if I'm making anything up, you can tell me to. A lot of performances are homogeneous in that only the participants that are sharing similar views feel at liberty to sort of add to the conversation.
Right.
But at the same time, you also seem to believe in that these spaces also help form transitional ways of being and systems of identity and identification and stuff like that that sort of get away from monolithic understandings of identity and queerness and things like that. So how do you do you see the internet as offering spaces in which to do what I just said, like sort of allow more fluid understandings of identity and of queerness,
right,
or do you see it as sort of quite limited?
Both.
Okay.
I think that any scenario, any space, all spaces are pedagogical, like this space. There's 100, probably 1,000 different pedagogical rules and practices that tell us how to hold our body in these spaces, how to speak, and so on and so forth. And yet, it's also quite clear that no matter what the categorical overlay, no matter what the conditions of recognition, no matter how limited they are, that invariably we will exceed in one way or another those conditions. And so it's the case that we probably have to keep hold of some kind of notion of identification. It's very difficult to have any kind of intersubjective communication at all without identification. And to recognize the violences that are perpetrated in the name of recognition, at the same time as to recognize that in these spaces, in particular people's mobility across spaces, that we take things from one space into another, and that the constant influx of life, the force of becoming, is going to continue to allow for novelty and new forms of life.
Any other questions? No, people are thinking. Hey, Mary, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was a brilliant.
Thank you for your great questions.